Good morning, honorable members and the delegation from the NRF, Department of Science and Technology. I'm sorry that I had to have some 5 minutes delay. There was something that I had to do first before I come in. I think today we had a very nice interaction last week visiting some of the NRF facilities. Quite impressive, and we had a good interaction, and I'm sure that today is a very appropriate day for us to listen to your strat plans and hear the way forward about all the plans that we have for the project that we visited even last week. I hope that most of the members did present themselves. I can't remember exactly who was there and who was not there. But I don't think there's any much discussion to while away time with, except to just jump onto the points themselves. I'll give it to you as a matter of procedure. We will introduce ourselves because there may be some new faces around there, and therefore probably it's better that we start from that platform. I am the chairperson of the committee, Ngaba Ngobo. I won't say much today about what Ngaba means because they say it delays time. I've got Shanaz here, who is our committee secretary. Most of you are used to her. You deal directly with her. We've got our committee whip here, who is going to introduce herself to you. And then we've got all members that we've got. At the end, that side, our researcher, Renee. And I think people from the department will be introduced by the department themselves, because I see there is a DDG here. Maybe we'll introduce his delegation from the department. Yeah, let's start from you, Honorable Whip.
Linira Tunja, ANC, from the Eastern Cape. A member of the Portfolio Committee.
I'm Ananyama, member of the Portfolio Committee from the ANC.
I'm Marion Shin, Democratic Alliance.
Peter Smith, IFB.
This side.
Jay, I'm Albert van Jaarsveld. I'm President and CEO of the NRF, and I'll ask my colleagues to introduce themselves quickly down the line.
Thank you. I'm Bishan Singh. I'm the CFO at the National Research Foundation.
I'm Belinda Bazzoli, and I'm the Chair of the Board of the National Research Foundation.
I'm Katja Maltulela, the Vice President at the NRF, responsible for research infrastructure and national research facilities.
I'm Patrick Thompson. I'm the Group Executive responsible for HR and stakeholder relations.
I'm Magda Marx. I'm the Board and Corporate Secretariat.
Chairperson and members, honorable members, my name is Malapa Kobela, Deputy Director General for Human Capital and Knowledge Systems in the Department of Science and Technology.
Honorable members, it's Petua Madudu, Chief Director for Human Capital in the Science Platform within the Department of Science and Technology.
Luyanda France, Parliamentary Liaison Officer, Ministry.
Lung Nangele, Media Liaison Officer, Ministry.
Martin Mulcahy, Special Advisor to the Minister of Science and Technology.
Tabi Mawela, Parliamentary Liaison Officer in the Office of Deputy Minister Aneko.
I see we've got some people behind there. Are they from media? Can you introduce yourselves? We want to know who you are.
Good morning. Good morning, Jane, everybody. I'm from Osu 7-8.
Okay. There's another one that side.
Zaira from TMJ.
I got here. Can you move to the microphone?
Zaira from PMG.
Oh, PMG. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. I think let me give to the CEO and the chair to lead us.
Chairperson, it's a great honor and privilege to be here to present our team, present our business plan, and you have asked for a special focus to be put on the issue of students and what we're doing for students, and we have done that, I hope, to your satisfaction. But we are we look forward to the presentation. I mean, I think that's about all I need to say to get going nice and quickly. Thank you.
Remind everybody about the mandate of the NRF Act. And that's not saying it's an act. Essentially, our mandate is to fund human resource development and to provide the necessary research that is required nationally in order to facilitate the creation of knowledge. This is in all fields of study, in all the words there. And of course, the ultimate objective of all those investments is to achieve the quality of life in South Africa. So that's really the act of based on that, we developed our Vision 2015, which we've shared with you previously, and I'm not going to spend much time on that, but just to remind you that there's a vision of world-class research to transform society and sustainable environment, and we leverage our act, our purpose, and people and platforms to deliver the human capacity development, research and innovation, and science. And in order to do that, we have to develop certain competencies within the organization. From that, we developed the 5-point strategic plan of the NRF as one thing on the internationally competitive science, technology, and innovation system, representative research and technical workforce in South Africa, world-class science benchmarking and grant system, leading edge research technology and innovation platform, of course, the facilities in the future, and an vibrant national science system. I think we have to develop a culture of a science system and science. In order to achieve that, there are certain core competencies that we have to deliver on. First of all, we have to make sure that our ground management systems are leading edge. We have to have world-class benchmarking practices in terms of the way we run our business. We have to have science and technology management expertise, state of the art research platforms, and then specialized research capacity at the national level. Seeking information about our R&D system is critically important for us to monitor and measure our progress. We have to be able to capitalize local international science collaboration with our partners. Our science not only must be world class, but it must also be world engaged. In other words, it needs to be part of the world science system. And of course, science advancement is particularly important. We do feel that as a society, we need to grow the message of science in our society in terms of the benefits of the world. As an organization, we have a code of conduct, ethics, and values, which we all subscribe to. These are not determined by management, determined by our staff. They came up with these values, and these are the values that we live and try and live by on a daily basis. To remind you about our organizational structure, we do have the presidency and the corporate support services, finance and business systems, and human resources stakeholder relations, represented by Bishop and Patrick. And then we have three large divisions. The first, of course, is the grant-making side of the business, which is represented by Dr. Jansen Filler, unfortunately, which can't be here today. He's in China at the World Exhibit, long ago there. And, but we also have our Vice President for Research Infrastructure and National Facilities, Dr. Jansen Filler. I mean, but the cross-cutter is a very important sponsor, because CASA is our science advancement leg of our activities, and they leverage the activities at the national facility as well as our program in this regard to promote the message of science. As an organization, as part of our strategy, we've developed a number of inventive principles. We always fund things only using professional approaches. It's just so far an international best practice in this regard. We use rigorous peer review. We fund activities. As an organization, I think we've come to the understanding that we need to achieve a balance between strategic-driven research on the one hand, and then demand, or if you like, blue-sky academic research on the other hand. We do need a balance, otherwise the diversity of our research is going to decline over time. We allocate resources strategically to attain these goals at the end of the day. The PhD we consider to be a critical system driver, not because it's the only thing we're interested in, but simply because it's a measure of our success in the whole pyramid of possible qualifications that people can succeed in. And we measure our international competitiveness using this. We do believe in rotation of expertise, in other words, moving people from the academic sector into the NRF and vice versa. We have a system of fellows, people that come to assist us with special projects. And that's something that we try and encourage. We live by the principles of fairness, transparency, and accountability, and it's just transformation in terms of our grant making system. We drive that all the time, and we'll give you a bit more information about that. In terms of alignment with departmental objectives and goals, just to remind you that a large chunk of our alignment is related to the R&D strategy of 2002. For instance, the areas where South Africa is geographic advantage, we do tend to make quite large investments in those areas. These are areas where we really have the ability to establish a competitive advantage to the neighbors in other countries or other parts of the world. Astronomy is one of those, paleontology is another one, marine biology and Antarctic research, leveraging the southern oceans and our access to the southern oceans, and indigenous knowledge systems. These are the areas where we have an opportunity to really utilize our own geographic position. Key technology missions, advanced manufacturing, biotechnology, ICT, and poverty alleviation, and technology, all of them receive special attention to one or other program within the NRF funded by the Department of Science and Technology at the end of the day. And of course, not just through the NRF, also through PR now and many of the mechanisms that are being locked up in here as that unfolds. And of course, we align ourselves with the grand challenges of the DSC innovation plan to say that we have to try and promote research in those areas. This is just a map. I don't want to read the details for you, but it gives you a sense of some of our strategic goals as an organization and the 10-year innovation plan strategic goals. And it just indicates to you that there's quite a good mapping in terms of our priorities versus the 10-year plan priorities. And so I don't think the alignment as far as that's concerned is a good topic. We do think that there's an opportunity for us using our areas of geographic advantage and other strategic investment areas for South Africa to position itself as a country as a science, international science destination in the future beyond the interstate, beyond the World Cup, by virtue of the infrastructure and the expertise that we have in this country. And we can contribute to the knowledge economy, human capital, infrastructure, and maybe science tourism into the future if we use this problem. Investment in grant challenges. This gives you an idea of our current investments. These are the grant challenges contained in the 10-year innovation plan, and the kinds of percentage investments we're making there. That's of course in institutional environments, and this includes the national facilities, human capital development, the two large chunks, and then spread across the others as in that fashion at this stage. In the areas of geographic advantage, we also make quite large investments in the area of astronomy, and smaller ones in the area of biodiversity, paleontology, etc. The kind of equipment bases that they need, of course, very different from the astronomy environment. There are a large number of additional instruments that we at the NRF use to steer and direct our science investments in the system. This is just a list of some of them, and I know you're having a special session discussion about some of these instruments next week with the department. But the centers of excellence are an important steering mechanism where we grow mass of expertise in a particular area that gives us a strategic advantage. And that is particularly relevant to our country. So we have a center of excellence in hard materials, leveraging the Beers investment, urban investment. We grow our competence in that area. We have one in invasion biology. But we have significant problems in the Western States with invasion species. Research chairs, I know you're going to be discussing those in detail next week, so I'm not going to spend much time on that. But there are also research facilities that carry flagship programs. The Ikebaki program, for instance, at HMO is a good example of that. The HF program is run from South African Institute for Aquatic Biodiversity, which is the marine research along our coastline. These are flagship projects that are not only national, but have international participation and draw resources into the country. We have a large number of research programs that are funded through contracts, both for the Department of Science and Technology as a primary source of many of those contracts, but also some other departments. We work with, historically, the Department of Labor, now the Department of Higher Education and Training, as far as the scarce school funding is concerned. We have a TIP program that we run on behalf of DTI, so we do manage programs for other departments as well. And then, of course, there are some research programs that are funded through the NRS core grant. Now, the shift that's occurred in the last 2 years or 3 years as far as the core grant is concerned is the majority of the programs that we fund through the core grant are directed at basic fundamental research. In other words, less strategic, if you like, aligned with strategic objectives in terms of human capital development and infrastructure and other things that you want to do at the end of the day. But this is really, and of course, growing the next generation of scientists. That always happens in a disciplinary context, and we try and leverage those opportunities. Of course, we have a problem in our system, and we hope that these strategic investments will make a contribution, quite solve the problem altogether, towards resolving some of these systemic problems. Like we have 31% of university academics have a doctoral degree. The latest report from Johan McCormick indicated 31% is even lower than we thought in terms of the number of proportion of academics. Hold the PhD. This is something that we have to reverse if we want to become successful. What we do is in the NRS, in order to achieve our strategic objectives, we've identified a number of investment areas in which we invest. Of course, we invest a large chunk of funding in established researchers, those people that are training the next generation of students, that are conducting cutting-edge research and driving our science endeavor in the country. We invest a large chunk of money into developing the next generation of scientists. All these investment areas we think are critical. If we didn't invest in them, we wouldn't be doing our job. We are investing some money in strategic knowledge fields. Many varied opportunities, and including the centers of excellence, are locked into those areas. We do invest some money in applied and industrial research. It's a strip program that we run for the DTI. The idea here, of course, is that any technological innovations that spin out of that we can transfer that here and they can do the commercialization on our behalf and we don't have to get involved. Strategic platforms, in other words, the large science instruments and some of the developments at the national facilities. We do have to internationalize our science, so we invest some of our money there. Community engagement research, small investment, but a very critical investment. Many of our universities are expected to do community engagement, and what we're trying to do is to understand what kinds of community engagement actually work for the community at the end of the day. So this is not funding community engagement per se, this is simply to say we need to understand how community engagement works and what is actually effective, and so we're making a strategic investment there. And then of course the focus area programs, which are historical programs that we're phasing out in order to take that money and reinvest in these programs and to make sure that we can the kinds of investment levels that we'd like to achieve. I think it's critically important for us, more or less on balance, if you look at the NRF over a few years, you'll see that our spread of funding, 75% of it comes from contracts, from various resources, sources, 25% of it from core funding, more or less. That's the sort of usual spread. And we're working very hard with the department to try and see if we can amend this moving forward. I do want to say something about bursaries because I think it's a special request from the committee. On the left-hand side here, you have the historic bursary levels as they were last year, meaning the last year. So on honors student is 15,000, masters up to 7,000 full time, doctoral 45,000. And those levels that you see there are what we at the NRF consider to be ideal bursary levels. If you wanted to fund somebody and maybe be happy that they have sufficient resources to do the degree that they're registering for, plus a little bit of extra, because we know that there's family commitments and other things that many of these students have to deal with, those would be the ideal bursary levels that one would strive for. Of course, they're quite a stretch from where we are, but I thought it's important to share that with the parliamentary committee. Our NRF bursary value has been constant since the financial year 2007-08. Based on those levels, we know and we understand that our bursary levels are too low. In order for us to get to those ideal levels and to increase the number of students that we fund, we're going to have to make an injection of about 300 million into the core grant to actually fund our students effectively and to grow the number of students. We'll get back to that. We have a number of student funding options that are available. Some of the student bursaries are grant holder linked. In other words, if you, through a competitive process, gain a grant from the NRF, there will be students attached to the work of students as a supervisor at the end of the day. Large chunk of those are in that category. And then we also have a number of freestanding scholarships. This is where students apply on their own merit, and they then give them the scholarship, and they then hunt for a suitable supervisor across the academic system. So we have both instruments. I think both of them are important, and we're also trying to promote the idea that students should move from institution to institution, and much of that mobility is attached to the freestanding scholarship. We have stated publicly as the NRF that our intention is to try and reverse this ratio. I think we need more freestanding scholarships and less grant holder universities. If we can't take them off the table altogether, I think grant holder universities are important. But maybe the ratio needs to be turned around and shifted. As far as transformation management is concerned, we at the NRF are driven, as stated, to our strategic objectives to drive transformation. We have explicit targets that we're trying to achieve as far as freestanding and grant holder universities are concerned, and these are the targets that we work to in terms of the investment that we make. So 80% of our bursaries go to black candidates, 15% of our bursaries go to the rest of Africa, and 5% of the international. So this is a different target that we try and achieve to get a nice mix of our commitment towards Africa, but also towards our local students. We also try and deal with the need-based approaches. There are some students that, of course, need more resources because the family incomes are so low, and we'll get back to that a little bit in a moment again as well. We do have a problem in terms of black student retention and assistance. Many students, unfortunately, when they achieve a first or a second degree, are under pressure from their families to go out into the workplace and earn a living. And they start working, and they never get the opportunity to actually achieve their full potential and continue to do the PhD, simply because it's now somebody else's turn to be supported by the family, and the person has to go back and start working. So we have a system in our problem dealing with inherent poverty in our society means that many students are denied the opportunity to achieve their full potential and maybe achieve a PhD if that was their particular ambition. We do have a problem also in our ability to influence the social system. As an NRF, we only fund a limited number of students at the end of the day. Only 15% of all the registered PhDs in the system are funded through the NRF. So we can try as hard as we like to try and move the target, but if we're only funding a small proportion of them, we're not really having a systemic influence at the end of the day. It will take us an extremely long time to get there. And I think that's the problem that we're trying to do. Of course, the poor PhD completion rates across the system is a problem. We have large numbers of students that are registered as part-time students in the system that take a very long time to complete. We at the NRF try and, by far the majority of our investments are in full-time students. So we try and encourage full-time study, and I think our success rates of our students are certainly higher than every student in the system. But we try and encourage our students to go to full-time study route. I think it's also important for an economy to have people that are fully qualified at the age of 25 or 28 and can actually inject their lifetime or their training into a lifetime career than having people achieve a PhD at the age of 51 and can make a limited contribution to our economy. And I think we need to try and push the full-time angle as much as we can. As far as our total impact on human resource development is concerned, we'll give you some historic information. First of all, the numbers across different categories, about 6,000 students on average per year over the last couple of years that we've managed to fund. Of course, we have pushed up the student bursary values. That meant that the numbers have sometimes declined. Every time we adjust the student bursary values, that means we can support less students. And so we have this balancing act that we're trying to achieve within the organization as far as that's concerned. Our funding levels in 2008, this was 5,400, slightly lower for 2008, but it excludes the centers of excellence students. This was in the previous slide. But I think the last column here is the one that I think is particularly important. It comes back to this notion of how much can we as the NOS actually steer the system at the postgraduate level in terms of what we're trying to achieve. We only fund about 2% of all honors students, 6% of master's students, 15% of doctoral students who are registered. But on average, if you just count the, look at the numbers, we only fund 5% of the students in the system. And these are the people that we can drive and we can steer through our mechanisms to try and achieve our objectives. And frankly, I don't think we have the kind of influence that we should be having in the system based on those sort of investigations. If you're concerned about the equity profile of what we've achieved, 2008 and 2009 figures to demonstrate to you that we do drive the equity issue. Honor students, 73% of them were black in 2009. Women 59% on honors level, master 53% black, 53% women in 2009, and doctoral 51% black, and 51% women. So we really are trying our best, and there's some historic information on the slide in front of you as well if you want to go back and see what that picture looked like in 1994, which is very different from the kind of level that we have to learn. We really try and drive the system. We believe honestly and sincerely that our science system in this country will never be competitive unless we have participation from everybody in the country. We don't have participation from 100% of our talent, we are never going to deliver. As far as selection criteria, this is one of the questions that was asked by the committee as far as how do we decide which students to fund at the end of the day. We look at scientific quality, and the marks that students achieve are important. Some of them at higher levels have publications and conference proceedings and so on. But it's actually produced outputs that we can assess and evaluate them with. We use peer review mechanisms to evaluate those students. We ask the supervisors, are these students of quality, are they going to finish this degree in a number of years? We look at the capacity of the institution the student is registering at. Is this an area that this institution has actually had some expertise? We only want to send people to an institution where there's no supervisors. If you look at the demographics, our target is important, race, gender, disability, and nationality, as we said earlier. We also sensitive to try and drive people in the system that are active and ongoing students, people that are driving their careers to get to a point to where they want to try and complete their PhD. If people have been working for 5 years and want to come back into the system, it's a little bit more difficult for us to fund them than somebody who's really just completed their master's and want to do their PhD and they want to be in the cutting edge of what they're doing. So that's a limitation, but driven by a funding limitation. We do look at the discipline in some funding programs because there are things like peer skills that are of national importance. So when we assess students, are they working in areas that are considered a peer school or not? And so that's part of the consideration in terms of allocating the building. In 2010, the Department of Science and Technology came to our rescue, if you like, and made a very important injection of additional funds to try and up our bursary student values. They injected an additional $52.7 million to increase bursary values to address uptake. But one of the things that we started realizing is that our bursary values were so low that students were not taking up the bursary because they said, you know, they can't survive, they'd rather go work somewhere else or find a bursary from another place. So the bursary value issue is becoming quite important and trying to affect the uptake of those bursaries at the end of the day. So we did this with recent address. The department came to our assistance here. We also need to look at needy students, and we've been explicit instructions about we need to look at that as an organization. So what we did is to increase the freestanding and grant holder bursaries as from this year, 2010, based on that cash injection from the department. Honors bursaries have moved up from 15,000 to 20,000 this year. Master bursaries from a minimum of 30,000 to 40,000 minimum across our lowest funding categories, and doctoral degrees from 45,000 to 60,000 rand per annum. This is a very nice shift in our funding base that allows us to secure students and make sure that people who need to have the opportunity to consider carrying on with their postgraduate degrees. And then also for needy students, on top of those values that you see there, we've indicated to the universities through the normal income assessment processes to let us know whether some of these students have a household income to below 300,000, which is aligned with the NISPA assessment of poor households. And then we will top up those bursary values with an additional 10,000 rand possible. So a needy PhD student can at least get 70,000 rand in a year to try and drive it. I don't want any suggest or even intimate that these values are adequate. I don't think that they are adequate. Remember, we showed you the ideal bursary values earlier. But I think it's a step in the right direction in terms of trying to send a signal to our academics and students to be serious about support. As far as some of our activities in the grant-making side of the business are concerned, we have a number of directors that focus on different parts of our business. The first is knowledge field development. This group of people look at underdeveloped disciplines or disciplines that need support from the NRS to be able to develop and become competitive. They have a number of mechanisms, including the Centers of Excellence, and a number of special programs that they manage, such as the Arctic program and so on. But this is really their focus. This just gives you an idea of the money as the MPF allocation for 10-11. That is a contract funding and a total funding. So it gives you an idea of the spread in that particular system. We also have a very new important directorate called Applied Research and Innovation. The objective of this directorate is to support many government departments in terms of rolling out some of their funding initiatives that they want to roll out, based on their sector-specific requirements. And the idea is to support research with innovation, and particularly important with the emphasis on social beneficiation, because I think we at the NRF understand that innovation is much broader than technological innovation, which is the ambit of the TIA, Technology Innovation Agency. The aspects of policy, other forms of innovation that can significantly affect the quality of life of people, which is what we call social beneficiation. That we have to research and support at the end of the day. Issues around housing, good governance, sustainability, community health, poverty, etc., food security, and so on, where we can contribute. And it's not necessarily going to be, the end product not necessarily going to be technological. These are funded through sector-specific departmental budgets, so we don't use core funding for this. We don't use the DSP science system funding for this. This is really where the Department of Agriculture would come and talk to us. So if we want to do something in the food security area, we need help to manage this program and how they are, and we can assist them trying to do that. So again, trying to service the whole of government as an agency. And the program is a good example. We're doing something like that for the BTI at the moment already. We have a director, human and institutional capacity development, looks at supporting our existing researchers in South African PhD projects, the TUCA program, developing the next generation of young researchers, the Racing Track program, which is in development together with the department, the Research Chairs Initiative, and the Incentive Program for Rated Research. All those initiatives are housed within this particular director, and looks really at taking individuals from pre-PhD, getting them through the PhD, spending 5-6 years of investment post the PhD so that they can have a competitive CV that they can put on the table and then apply for an academic position at the higher education institution in a competitive way. So it's really about the pipeline of the individuals in the system to try and make sure that we develop people from pre-PhD all the way to the point where they can actually qualify as PhD. International Relations and Cooperation, together with the colleagues at the Department of Science and Technology, we have the Science and Technology Agreement Fund that is being managed on behalf of the department, and really look at the bilateral and trilateral relationships that we have with other governments. We internationalize our science to make sure our scientists can visit the best science facilities abroad, and that we attract people into our system to come visit and share their expertise and knowledge with our researchers at the end of the day. And that's what this director focuses on, is to try and leverage that investment in international agreements for the benefit of science. We have a director of knowledge management and evaluation. This is where many, the rating system is out there, but many of our knowledge management systems in terms of our national PhD database accessible and being used by many researchers from the country is available, and people step into that system all the time to try and get information about what's happening as far as our PhD database. So there's the PhD databases. We also drive the journal access initiatives for many of the institutions, particularly the national facilities today. Directors, and then very important, as we run programs, we have to undergo periodic reviews of those programs. In other words, we have to say, is this program delivering the goods that the client wants at the end of the day? Every 5 years, there's a program review. The review is done through international peer process, and we use that information to either upgrade, close down if the program wasn't delivering, or say we have to redirect or reinvigorate the program somewhere. So part of our reviewing mechanism happens to this director. Essentially, sits as a referee, if you like, and looks at the other programs to say, are you doing your job? Grant management and systems administration, GMSA, this is the engine room of our grant-making activities. It contains the IT systems that people use to apply online for their grants, to apply online for their studentships. We do the payments through the studentships, the record-keeping, the progress reports are harnessed from the community and assessed in that directive. So this is really the engine room. It uses all those other directives and says, are we efficient in terms of delivering an efficient service to our clients at the end of the day? And so that doesn't have a separate budget to leverage for the other aspects. Just to give you an indication of the scale of operations of the NRF at the moment, this gives you some history. This is the MTF allocation over time, and then it's contract allocation over time, the maroon bar. And then the total bar, which is really the interesting one at the end of the day, is called these two things which complement each other. They're not separate entities at the end of the day. Many of the contracts focus on human capital development and add to our ability to deliver on our objectives. And essentially, the budget is about growing just over ₹1.2 billion in that vicinity as we are NRFP at the moment. We have some challenges in RESA. Diversity values, I spoke to that earlier, but we also have to increase the numbers. If we want to have impact on the system, we have to be able to support more students. The reality is, as an organization, we fund 3 out of 10 students that apply to us. We could do a lot better if we had more resources at the end of the day. And so we can have a larger impact. And of course, our ability to fund students also affects the application rate. If people know that it's highly competitive, we have few people that apply at the end of the day. So it's sort of a vicious circle that we find ourselves. We have to increase funding for fundamental disciplinary research into the future, and we need to see how we can get there.
Could you tell us the... I'm acting here like a parliamentarian. could you just tell us the proportional success rate there as well, given the limited amount of money in the core grant?
That's very important. Same as the students, as far as the research applications are concerned. On average, across our program, we fund 4 out of 10 people that apply. So it's about a 40% success rate at this level and a 30% success rate at that level, which does indicate that our processes are highly competitive, but it also means that we have a lot of frustrated researchers out there that would like to get access to our funding and not succeed. We would like to be able to support them, but we can't. Where we are at the moment, we do want to ensure appropriate mix between fundamental and directed research. We've spoken about this earlier. Strengthen our peer review system and rating system, as requested by Higher Education South Africa. I think it's really important to emphasise that we were asked by ESSA, and they did a complete review of our rating system and came back to us. We need to strengthen that system, and we need to make it focused on its core objectives at the end of the day. And we're working very hard with them to try and achieve that. We have to optimize the deployment of the CS Skills Fund. We're working again very hard with the Department of Higher Education and Training, the DG there, to see how can we use that fund for the benefit of postgraduate students. I think the philosophy is, historically, the CS Skills Funds are primarily geared towards developing skills at a post-school level. I think the department and I think the Minister of Education has indicated already in their strategic plan that philosophy should adopt a pipeline approach, which should be funding people all the way to PhD using CS Skills Fund. Because PhD just ask CS Skills, irrelevant, irrespective of which discipline they're from. All right, so we have to improve our administration of binational and bilateral agreements. I think there's room to work with the department there. And then strengthen our strategic platform collaboration program. Second major division of the organization is DASA, which is our science advancement arm. They focus on a three dimensions. First of those is science education. We work with school groups, many school competitions, activities that they run. They involve in science communication, many activities. For instance, some of their materials you may be interested to know is being used by the parliamentarians in Norway to train parliamentarians on science and technology issues. So they take the material off the website and use it in Norway's parliament. So I thought it would be interesting for you to know that they are doing a lot of good work there. And then science awareness platforms, the National Science Week, all the other activities that I may do faster. As far as the finances of software is concerned, this gives you the history, NTS contracts in total. Again, large number of contracts drive the activities, and I know that you are concerned to people in the system. But there are some major infrastructure questions around software that we as an organization have to resolve. They were handed to the Johannesburg Observatory site a few years ago, and they are exploring the refurbishing of the site to accommodate the multi-purpose space of the Interactive Science Park, which is specific focus on astronomy and engineering as one option. Of course, the reality is they presently house in the Didacta building in Skinner Street in Victoria, and the question is, do we retain these two activities or do we consolidate them maybe as one of those sites and see if we can focus the activities a little bit moving forward. Of course, they have very close interaction with the National Zoological Gardens, where they're trying to develop a life science center. These plans are being developed, but of course, this is a large cash injection that we want to have to achieve in order to make that kind of impact. The major question or challenge for us around SASA at this stage in the game, in the future of the Johannesburg Observatory site, should this be a flagship national site from which science advancement is driven nationally? In collaboration with many of the provincial and other initiatives that exist around the country, our question is essentially the following. Who in this country is responsible for driving public understanding of science? It's a brief that nobody has really adopted. I mean, every department does some of it. The Department of Science and Technology does a lot of it. But as an agency, as somebody who is reasonably to drive public understanding of science, I think there's an opportunity for SASA to make that kind of impact in the system that hasn't been made in the past. National facilities. The first of those is the South African Astronomical Observatory. It focuses on optical astronomy, infrared astronomy, and astrophysics research. Of course, they also operate the large SALT telescope at Sutherland on behalf of a 12-member consortium of the SAO. Of course, the NRF is the largest shareholder. That gives you an indication of the budget and where they stand at the moment. They are concerned about refurbishing some of the infrastructure in the organization. There were concerns about the false operations levy. To maintain the shareholding of South African astronomy, the idea is that you own 30% of the shareholding of the telescope, the astronomers can use 30% of the time. And if our levy is not retained at the level where we can retain 30% of the shareholding, it means our astronomers will have less time on the telescope at the end of the day. And that's a very important issue that I think we need to manage. Of course, there's also an increased demand from other African countries for participation and support in terms of astronomy. Many of them are putting up their own astronomy facilities. I know the department just visited Mozambique in terms of the collaborations around the SKA, MIRCAS, and so on. And there are very important discussions going on with people in Egypt, for instance, that are refurbishing their 9-meter telescopes, etc. So we are making that sort of impact as well. Radio astronomy, which of course is a different kind of instrument altogether, rather than looking at the stars, we're listening at the stars. As you saw last week in your visit to the facility down here. Important here are two issues. First of all, the Hartwell facility, where the 26-meter diameter radio telescope is situated. This is just a picture of it down here. This, you would have remembered, the media things broke last year, one of the buildings. What it means essentially, that's in the control of that huge dish. There's an access at the bottom there, and that buildings broke. And the reason why that buildings broke is because the telescope was established by NASA in the 1970s as part of the moon flight activity. It's a very old telescope. It's way beyond its sell-by date. We've been extracting maximum value of it for many years. We looked at this very carefully, but we're actually just in the process with the
great that the department has allocated to us the resources of fixing the hearing that should be done by the network. So hopefully the telescope will be fully functional. And as you can see, the telescope is particularly important in terms of some international VLBI work that they're doing. If you take that telescope out of the network, you'll see we have a very strict picture of what's going on as far as that resource is concerned. So these are critical instruments. So we have to maintain their competitiveness, and of course, as we discussed last week as well, in the long run, the Meerkat telescope, which is also a radio telescope built in the Karoo, the operation needs to be integrated with Hotstar. Of course, this is a radio astronomy facility, facilities operating on behalf of the country, and we have to make sure that they are fully integrated. We visited Meerkat last week. I'm not going to spend much time here. You know what SKA is anticipated to be. That's the kind of funding levels we're at the moment. One of the problems we face in the SKA project, of course, is to retain the skilled people that we need to drive the system. You've met many of those people last week. These people are internationally highly sought after and can quite easily poach from us if we're not very careful. So we're working very hard to retain them, but we also have to grow the number of radio astronomers in this area to make sure that we have more people that we can tap on. Skills attention is a major problem here, and the other problem is that the operations budget for Meerkat is not quite in place. We've talked to the department about this. One of the challenges we have is to avoid the kind of problems we had in the rollout of the SOLT telescope, where the construction people finished the telescope, left the site, the scientists came on site and looked at the telescope and said, "Oops, we're not really doing what we're supposed to do. There's a problem." Then they had to go through a long exercise of trying to fix it. And we're still in the process of trying to fix it. Hopefully by the end of the year it's finally be done and we can move forward. If other people still show up, we can do it. Okay, oh yes, we'll start it. So we hope we can get there. What we're trying to do here is to get the scientists to start using the equipment before the people in the near leave the site, so that we can make 100% sure that the operations are fully functional and it's actually delivering from a science perspective before the engineers deliver. Admirers the Magnetic Observatory. It's a worldwide network of magnetic observatories. It's one of those stations. They have very important tools and instruments, magnetometers, radars, some long frequent, low frequency receivers, GPS network in South Africa is maintained by them by and large. And they really are of strategic importance, both to the African National Defense Force and the aviation sector. Many of the gyroscopes and compasses and things that you see that are used in the aviation sector, both by military purposes and other purposes, are calibrated by these people on an ongoing basis, and they play a very important role. They've had budgetary constraints in the past. They've managed to gain a lot of income through contract work. There are some scarce skills that are vested in very few individuals. I know there's one individual that's about to eat today. Tomorrow, our aviation industry will be in serious trouble as a consequence. So, we need to grow the core competency in that area and make sure you have a critical mass. Student accommodation, as I talked about in the course, you will now know by now that this has officially been approved with that Magnetic Observatory as a mature facility that's servicing industry and other sectors of society will move from the NRF to the National Space Agency which has been established in the long run. I think in principle this has been approved and I think it's a better placement for that facility where they can have maximum impact. The reason for that movement is they also do a lot of space weather work. Space weather affects satellite communications and other IT infrastructure in the near space environment, and therefore they can make a consistent contribution to the space. The South African Institute for Aquatic Biodiversity in Grahamstown, we'll be able to show you that facility at some stage. They contain something like 25% in their collection of marine fish, 25% of all marine fish in the world contain in their collection. It's a very important international collection, and we're looking after it very carefully. A lot of biodiversity and marine-related research is run from this area, and there's a lot of expertise in coastal biodiversity, conservation planning, environmental education, and details of biodiversity conducted through that facility on behalf of the nation at the moment. One of the flagship projects I mentioned earlier, the African Tibetan Ecology Ecosystem Program, the ACET program, is now in the second phase, and fully funded through the Department of Science and Technology. And what this program has done is actually leveraged international investments that have expanded that program from a South African base to look at the whole east coast of Africa
and has launched a whole international participation through a UNDP-funded program and has really made our local science internationally relevant in that regard. So it really has expanded the scope of the impact. The African Environmental Observation Network, this is a network of nodes around the country to provide quality information about the quality of our environment to society. They have expertise in a number of areas that they can tap into, but their prime objective is to not only monitor and measure the quality of the environment, but also turn that into information systems so we can have a long-term track record of our environmental quality moving into the future. We have to manage the implementation of the SAIL network. There's still a couple of nodes that have been rolled out this particular year, and there's a number of international agreements and other things that we have to try and rejuvenate as far as this is concerned. That's not quite been declared a national facility yet, although we're managing it as a national facility. This is an ongoing discussion with the department that we have to have. National Zoological Gardens, one of our most recent acquisitions, represents a science advancement platform. We have 600,000 people visiting the National Zoological Gardens in the year, of which about half of them are school kids. It's one of the most magnificent experiences that any of you have a free Sunday. It's a nice sunny day. I suggest you go to the National Zoological Garden. It's in the downtown part of Pretoria, and I think people are always surprised when they actually go there and they enjoy the gardens and the environment it offers to families and other people right in the heart of Pretoria. So it's an important ecotourism site. But at the same time, what we're trying to do there as a National Research Foundation is to establish a core competency of science in the areas of small population management, conservation biology, conservation breeding of endangered species. And we're working very hard with the directors to try and establish it. We've just established a new conservation science center at the zoo, and they've appointed their first batch of researchers in working in that area in collaboration with some of the higher education institutions in that environment. So, as an ecotourism facility, as a facility that has huge public science advancement potential, we also have to make sure that it delivers as far as the science facility. There are issues about decaying infrastructure at the zoo. This has been funded through the Department of Public Works for many years. And frankly, it's underfunded, and many of the decaying infrastructure needs to be upgraded, and we are trying to address that together with the department as we possibly can. A large chunk of our investment in Tegla Labs, which is a nuclear-based scientist, and it's critically important for people to understand that virtually all the nuclear scientists that this country possesses are trained through this platform, which is outside of Cape Town. You'll see it as you drive to some of the west on the left-hand side. They do a few things. First of all, they provide a unique radioisotope treatment facility, proton therapy center, for people from around the world, but also for South Africans and needy South Africans. They would not have access to this kind of cancer therapy facilities anywhere else in the world if it didn't exist in Tembo Labs. Secondly, they drive a very large nuclear science program, serves as the basis for training of up to 400 students a year, postgraduate students involved with this particular facility. And the third activity that they're involved with is the production of very rare radioisotopes that are used in medical diagnosis. In other words, when you go to the medical doctor and they inject you with isotopes that they follow on the x-ray machine to see what's wrong in your system, they probably come from the Tembo Labs down the road here at the end of the day. Together with Nectar, the Tembo Labs is the largest radioisotope production producer in the world. We have a competitive advantage in this regard, and there's a strategic alliance being established between Tembo Labs at the moment and Nectar to make sure that we even increase our advantage even further. There's some challenges about equipment upgrades. Some of these big cyclotrons that they work off have been in... How long have they been there? Sorry? Early 60s they were developed. So, I mean, this is aging infrastructure, and we have to think about how we maintain that moving forward. The important part of having a laboratory like that, when people do research on this kind of infrastructure, is that the students are actually called to build and maintain these systems. Very easy to get on the plane and go to France and to go and do research at an established facility and come back and publish your paper. But we don't have the expertise to build and maintain these systems.
do it that way. By having this facility here where these people are not only doing the training, but at the same time getting the expertise that you need to maintain the system for the future, you remain competitive in the area of nuclear science. Skills retention is always an issue. Electricity costs, of course, is a high energy environment. And I know that the budget, electricity budget for December is shot at like 2 billion rand this year due to tariff increases from a source that I'm not going to mention. This is the reality of running a research environment, and all of a sudden these unintended consequences, if you like, are the South End branch of the December Labs, which used to be called the Shonan facility, for those of you in the University of Witwatersrand, is now finding its feet. I think the work is starting there quite nicely, trying to complement the work done at December Labs here in Cape Town. But there is a bit of refurbishment required there, and we need to try and address that. As far as our national facilities in general are concerned, there's a big demand from our perspective at the NRF to recapitalize these national facilities. One needs to remember why national facilities were established in the first place. They were established and given to the NRF because they were the kinds of facilities that couldn't maintain themselves through commercial means. In other words, these are not the kinds of facilities that could generate large chunks of income. They were given to the NRF to manage because they had a certain competitive advantage that they offered. If we don't refurbish these facilities at the cutting edge, we will lose that competitive advantage in the long run. I think it's important for us to have that conversation and decide how we're going to do that. Our estimates are that it's going to require about 200 million over a period of 3 years, a total investment of 600 million, to get them back up to speed where all of them can be completed. But that's a large chunk of funding, and again, we're speaking to our colleagues at the department, we're in turn speaking to our colleagues at Treasury to see, can we make a dent in the start revisiting and invigorating the environment. Already the department has invested some 37 million in maintaining and upgrading its infrastructure over the last 2 years. So they're coming to the party. The baseline funding in the facilities have been eroded at the 60% of the target was set to them when they were established in the early 90s. And I think this is something that we should try and address to make sure that they retain their competitive edge. And of course, over the last couple of years, this is not unique to the national facilities of the NRF. The salary negotiations around the country have exceeded the budget increases, and that in the long run, of course, erodes your accessibility. This is a national trend, it's not something that's going to be online. As far as NRF finances are concerned, I'm just trying to reiterate that we set out our strategic vision. We wanted to grow the NRF from a 1.5 billion rand organization. Normal inflation increases would have resulted in about a 2.5 billion rand organization by the end of the strategic period, 2015, November. We set ourselves the target of growing ourselves to a 4 billion rand. That's a sort of more or less a doubling into the life of the core investments in R&D and science system is what we think will make it possible for our researchers to be reaching forward because our research needs to grow. But that's the target we're still working towards. We're certainly making progress in that regard. I think this year we were about 2.5 organizations because we have our budget about there. So we're making progress in the target. In order to deliver on this financial growth strategy, I think it's important that we have to work together with our colleagues in the industry. We also have to diversify our income streams as an organization. We have to provide services to other departments to make sure there's more research money available. Some of the government departments, industry, international partnerships, we have to leverage our investments in our own science to make sure that international partners can invest in our science system. That's why we're trying to work in the world. Our point of view is that growth strategy is required to realize the objectives of the strategic plan in 2015, so it's critical for us to achieve it. Otherwise, we are going to fall short on our objectives. This is the indication of multi-year funding, giving you an idea of expenditure at the NRF. That's salary, you see there in green, running costs in purple, and grants and bursaries in the top line there. This is an indication of what's happened over the last couple of years. We are trying to grow the grant as we can. Of course, the salary is also an issue because that's running at a faster rate than the total budget, and we have to manage our running costs as best we can. This is an indication of the potential to invest. Idea of the real cost structure of the organization. We really need to be quite a diverse organization. Our national facilities are research intensive environments, whereas our groundbreaking systems are actually very, very much cheaper to maintain than the research environment. We look at the agency function of reform. Our salaries are now for the next year anticipate 8% or 7% more or less of the total budget. OPEX 12% down to 9% in anticipation based on budget, and the grants are going to grow between 7% and 9% of the position. So we're trying to work on efficiencies and trying to improve efficiencies in the grant as the size of the procedure. And if you look at the national facilities, they have a very different cost structure. If you look at the shared services that are provided, they hover around 22-23%. And then the research platform provision part of our investment is hovering around just under the 80%. This is one of the concerns that we have, and we've shared with the department this time. I think this is the MGF, the purple graph, the baseline funding, and the CPIX, which is the inflation rate increases. And for the last 3 years at least, the increases in the NRF funding have been below the CPIX. And that in the long term erodes our ability to achieve our objectives and also puts pressure on our operations in terms of sustainability. If this trend should continue for a long period into the future, we have to be very concerned about it. So just to highlight that ongoing thing. We also have been asked by the department to implement some forced efficiency savings. This is due to the economic realities that the country and the globe are in. The efficiency saving of 20 million for this next year, 20 million for the next year, and 80 million after that has been envisaged. What we're trying to do as an organization is to say, we're not going to wait till that year for a crunch to try and deal with it. We're going to start putting in place savings right now to exceed the 20 million target that we can now, so we can build up a surplus that we can deal with the 80 million. Not what I want to call the surplus, what we call it. It's just the managing our finances in the sense that we can reinvest some of our savings from 1 year into the next year. It means we don't have to deal with the last chunk in 2012, 2013, so we're trying to improve our efficiencies at the moment to make sure that we can break even by 2012, 2013 to try and deal with it. And then I think the other thing is what we're trying to do is we're trying to save and putting in place to break even in 2012, 2013. And these are the assumptions that that's based on. Our salary will move on average 6% and operating costs 2%. I do want to emphasize that operating cost inflation is a major issue for us. Very low, the assumption there. In the science environment, it's international inflation that decides the cost increases. It's not something we can't even look at local inflation because the chemicals and things you buy are driven by international inflation. So we're going to deal with these efficiency savings over the next 3 years to allow break even by 2012, 2013. And that includes that, then absorbs 120 budget cuts. 120 million budget cut over 3 years. We're dealing with it in terms of embedded efficiencies in the 3 year budget, a saving of 15 million, and then a further saving of 7 million, which will be achieved in the following manner: three vacancies and staff rationalization of 10 million, reducing running costs and downsizing some of the operations of national facilities to the tune of 57 million, and a grant budget impact of zero increase in terms of part of the full grant structure. This is one of the objectives that the board gave us and said to us, whatever you do, you're not allowed the impact on the grant. So this is the consequence of that. You're going to have to deal with it another way as an organization. This is the last slide. I don't spend much time here. I'm not going to run you through the reams and reams of performance indicator data that's part of the business plan they put in the back. I just want to explain the context of that for you. Those indicators are presented in two different fashions. Not in the presentation, but in the business plan as it stands. In terms of how we're delivering or how we're progressing as far as our 2015 strategic targets are concerned as an organization, and we've grouped them and presented them in that context. But we've also grouped and presented them in the context of the national balanced scorecard approach as far as these two different dimensions are concerned. So you'll see a repeat, if you like, a repeat of those indicators, but just in two different topics presented to you to give you an idea of the early position. And on that note, I'm going to thank you for your support.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fernandez, for the good presentation. But for it to be good, let me hear what my members say. I've got Honorable Smith, Honorable Sheen there. I have those two hands for now.
Chairperson, thank you very much, and thank you very much, Dr. Garfield, for the presentation. I must say, I don't know where to start, because I've got so many questions that I don't know how the chair wants to handle this. So maybe there's some just issues for clarity as I go through, but then I think there are some broader matters. But if I can just do some clarity issues quickly. And unfortunately, because the slides are not numbered, it's a question of kind of finding... Oh, don't worry about that, though. Yeah. One of the slides talks about investment principles, and it talks about the balance between strategic-driven versus demand-pull investments at the disciplinary level. Now, I just want to get clarity on the strategy-driven, or the origin of the strategy-driven ones. Is it private sector? Is it state? Is it SOEs? Who determines the strategy? That's the question. Oh, my God, how do I go here? Oh, yeah. Then there's a slide on the investment of the grand challenges. Now, one of the things that always puzzles me is that although we as a country claim to invest in energy, it's very difficult to get figures on renewable energy. And even your slide here simply talks about search for energy security. Well, to me, that could just mean coal for 1,000 years. So my question is, are you investing at in your risk level in renewables? And if so, where and how much and so on and so forth? Then you talk about the additional instruments slide where you talk about the 31% of PhDs in academia, and said, of course, we need to up that. Well, of course, we need to up it. The question is, do we have a firm timeline with clear targets for that percentage? And I understand it's a bit difficult because your contribution is only 5%. But have you any idea whether the country then, asking you to go beyond your own brief, does the country have a target of how to address this in the broader term in terms of figures? From the 31 onwards. Pass that one. Sorry, Chair. Yeah, I mean, it's very nice. There's a slide here on student funding options. We talk about the contribution towards black students, West Africa, international, and so on and so forth. And the 15% funding for West Africa, which, I mean, it's great. It's great that we support the continent. My question really is, though, that how do you make a strategic determination of the quantum you put into that, given the fact that you're so short for your own domestic use? So who makes the decision to say, well, we need an extra 300 million, or whatever the figure was you mentioned somewhere, to fund our students, and yet we won't do that. We'll take 15% again and fund the rest of us again. Now, if somebody makes that decision, how is it made, and what are the criteria that end up on that 15%? Chair, you'll have to stop me when you want to, but if I can just carry on. Oh, yeah. The injection of the 52.7 million, which the minister in fact mentioned in her budget speech to us, and we're all very happy with it. My only question is that you're using that as the basis for new disbursements. You've upped it, which is great. But if it's a once-off, then you're in trouble. So have you had some sort of guarantee from the department that it's not a once-off, that it's going to be there in the MTEF? Otherwise, I don't know how you would strategically handle having to reduce figures. Sorry, Chairperson, who's here. Yeah, I was very concerned, in fact, about the slide where you spoke about the national facilities and some of the constraints, the challenges here. And one of them being, oh, sorry, this is a salt one, this operations levy, and our being able to fund the levy at the same time to maintain our percentage of the equity and the access. If that's a problem for salt, then I'm really worried about Meerkat and SKA. Because what's going to happen there? Do we have is there a guaranteed, has the state, in fact, made some commitments that problem won't arise? Because it was scarily stiff if that problem carries forward. And Chair, also, it's the same thing, similar thing, that you talk about the challenges on Meerkat being, all the engineering skills and retention strategies required. I mean, do we have a clear SKA skills retention strategy that's going to, because I would imagine that SATA could even be part of the assessment, of the international assessment of the two countries, could be partly, do you have the engineering capabilities to maintain this project? And if we are sitting here now saying, hey, we've got big challenges and it's not being addressed, could that threaten the viability of our, you know, of getting it? That would be a major issue there to me. I'll be very brief now on these here. Yeah, and there's a slide here on the Environmental Observation Network and all the good things they do. That's wonderful. I just wanted to know, because water quality is one there. We may have all these research competencies, but, I mean, for example, if you take our water quality in this country, certainly from the point of view of potable water for people consumption, there's an extraordinarily alarming trend of decreasing quality. Now, is there any sort of is this research in an abstract sense, or is it actually applied research which goes to feed straight into the Department of Water Affairs to identify hotspots and to intervene? Or is it just research? Because I really think we need help on the water quality front. And if the Department of Water Affairs, you know, isn't able to do it, somebody needs to help them. And then perhaps, Chair, just winding up here, some of these important challenges, I find it absolutely remarkable that, in fact, this aging equipment of ours, you know, which has been there sometimes from the 60s, actually requires so little to bring it up to speed. And yet it seems to be such tardiness from the point of view of the fiscus to deal with it. I mean, if you only need $200 million a year for 3 years, that's peanuts in the bigger scheme of things, in terms of bringing, because the implication here is all facilities back up to speed. If you only require that, I really struggle to understand, maybe the department sometime can tell us, you know, what they say to Treasury in terms of their engagement on the budget process, but I'm really intrigued that there's basically a no-no there, except this miserable 37 million. I mean, it's a drop in the ocean. Are people serious about science in this country? It seems they're not serious. At least the fiscus is not serious. Yeah, maybe, and then the last one, Chair, just to be, sorry, rude. There's a slide here which shows you your projected $4 billion organization versus 1.5 on trajectory. But it seems to be a very unfair slide, because you're starting this year with a fourth column which leaps above the others. The others don't have fourth columns. So I don't know whether what that trajectory is talking about. But this gives the impression that suddenly this year you leap, you know, a billion above where you were. In other words, the right and left-hand side of this year are not comparable. So I'm just trying to get some sense of why the trajectory suddenly rises. Well, it seems to me because on the left-hand side of the graph there's no column. So maybe just to speak to that. Thanks.
There were many, but I'm thinking that let's give the second member, because he may be asking only one or two. I don't know. Oh, okay. So you also have many. All right. Let's deal with those ones.
Can I just talk to the timing slide? The difference is, is historic information where we have real data. In other words, we know exactly what was going on as far as our total expenditure and our income is concerned. These are projections that, in order for us to achieve $4 billion, we should be striving to reach those targets in the future. And so that's just why the fourth column is there moving into the future, as a guide for us to what we should be striving to get in the short term future, including this year. Including this year, because the reality is that many of our contract funding incomes are only generated throughout the year. And we're estimating that just that we don't have a real data to work with. That's why only one slide. I do want to go back. Can I take them in reverse order? Thank you. As far as the injection and national facilities are concerned, I know that the department has presented this case to the National Treasury. I know the department is working on a much larger strategy for infrastructure investment in the science area as a whole, and this will be absorbed into that strategy because it's part of the package that they want to take to Treasury as a whole into the future. So this is just the NRF contribution to towards that broad strategy that I know the department is working on at the moment, so to give some context about that. The say on water quality issue, SAON has set up as a collaborative effort from many departments.
yes, there is a very intimate linkage between what Theron's observations and monitoring is giving us and the Department of Water Affairs. We have people from Water Affairs sitting on the steering committee and the advisory bodies of Theron Thursday. Actually, the chair of the advisory body at the moment is from the Department of Water Affairs. So that linkage is there, and hopefully we can get the the National Facilities Operations Levy, the salt thing that you referred to, it's not a huge amount of money. I think it's just an operational thing that we have to sort out between ourselves and the department about how much money goes here and there. I think the investment is about 7 million rand a year at the moment. So it's not a huge amount of money, but we have to maintain that and make sure. Part of the problem is that the investment decisions that are made by an international consortium, which then imposes a cost on us, and we don't have full control about what that cost is actually going to be, so we're trying to project it, and sometimes we miss it, and then we have to catch up in that regard. So I don't think it's an insurmountable problem. I think we can deal with it, but we have to keep our eye on that. This is just for salt at the moment. Remember, the SKA, Meerkat, of course, has to have an operation budget because that's a South African investment, and we would have to operate it into the future. Should we be successful as far as the SKA bid is concerned, then how that can operate and what kind of levy structure is going to be will have to be determined by the international consortium. We have no idea as to how that's going to look yet or how that's going to operate. And I think that's something that the international community needs to address itself. In any event, even if we were successful, that levy wouldn't be due before 2012, 2013 in terms of the rollout of the SKA. So that's future news that we want to people from that. Fuel retention, yes. Generation is a large chunk of the investment as far as this area is concerned. There's a target of 30% of the total budget that has to be invested. That's invested in human capital development. They're supporting at the moment over 250 master's and PhD students in the area of radio astronomy. Our problem is we're running out of supervisors to deal with them, and we're using international people. And as part of that result, we have now invested in the establishment of five research chairs in radio astronomy at South African University. One-off baseline, the 52.7 million for students. My understanding is, and maybe Malapa can help us there, that this is the basis of a discussion between the department and National Treasury in terms of moving this forward. So I think there's a common understanding about how this is going to be dealt with moving forward, and we're quite confident that it's not going to result in a huge catastrophe. I'm assuming that Malapa, do you want to add something to that, maybe?
Chair, I was just going to say that when we recognize the problem, because when you recognize the problem, you have to do something about it. It's not just simply a case of lamenting and saying that you have a problem. And so the investment that was made in this current academic year will hopefully yield the sort of benefits that are more sustainable going forward. What we are doing as part of our own MTF discussions with the Treasury, as well as looking internally within the department, are things that will ensure that sustainability, both in terms of growth, in terms of numbers, but also in terms of the quantum, because we also recognize that the quantum in itself is still not yet ideal.
Okay, thank you, Malapa. I think it's important. And then the next point, the question was on the 50% of the African students that we support as far as our benchmark. One needs to look at this in a broader context a little bit, unfortunately, and one understands the sensitivity that I think you're putting on the table as far as that's concerned. But we have many international and national agreements with African partners about science collaboration and science cooperation. And many of those investments are aligned with trying to deliver on those political agreements as far as science collaboration and so on is concerned. So in some sense, we have some flexibility to talk about what that target ought to be, but some degree of investment will probably be regarded to service those agreements as we move forward.
The next question was about the 31% of the PhDs in the higher education sector. Now, this is, unfortunately, I don't have the answer for you. Maybe Professor Bazzoli would be a better place to answer that, putting you on the spot. But I do know that there was a recent conference on higher education held by the minister and the DG in higher education to look at many issues around the effectiveness, the competitiveness, and the delivery of our higher tertiary education sector. And I know that one of the major concerns that was on the table was precisely the statistic and how they're going to drive that and move that forward. I think the minister said towards the end of the conference, his view is that if you apply for a position at a tertiary education institution, you should have a PhD. That's the international norm in highly competitive research environments. But, of course, we're a long way from there, and we'll have to work our way towards that and try and get there. So the Department of Higher Education and Training is acutely aware of this problem, and they're trying to put together strategies and targets and things in terms of achieving that. I think the one figure is mentioned there, Malapa, you can maybe help me out, is that they're striving, first of all, to achieve a 50% rate within the foreseeable future. I can't remember the date off the top of my head. But maybe, Malapa, you have those statistics at hand.
No, again, Chair, maybe this is some of the data that we could talk to next week with your permission, Chairperson. Because together with the Department of Higher Education and Training, we have set certain targets in terms of where we would like the system to be in time. This particular one is a very difficult one to actually set a short-term target simply because the gestation period to produce a PhD is very long. That's the one thing. And secondly, you are looking at also people who are working within a system. And so you have to change the profile of people who are already in employment. So we are working on some figures that hopefully we'll be able to put to you next week.
I think that question is very important, which he has asked, because he's asking the mechanisms that you use to make these decisions. Because there must be a policy mechanism upon which such things are based. Because we want to avoid a situation which we have already dealt with, I think, last week, where we have a problem of the manipulation of numbers and faces instead of addressing the truth of what we need. So it's a very important question because we have to have established policies into how, why, and how we do things. You know.
I can just agree. I think that's critically so, and I think this is why the Meerkat project was placed under due pressure to transform, because I think one understands that where you're dealing with equity issues, you have to look at people that were truly disadvantaged in that sense, and we have to make sure that we don't miss the target. I can just support that. The next question on my list here was the renewable energy question. I can just say that besides the investment in TEMA, which is not necessarily renewable, but is an energy sector investment in terms of what we do there, there are two major initiatives that I'm aware of that we invest in. First of all, there is a center of excellence that's been established at Stellenbosch University on renewable energy in the engineering department. So that's getting up nicely. It's not funded through the Department of Science and Technology. I think it's funded through the Department of Trade and Industry, if I'm not mistaken. But it's a similar mechanism that's been established, and that's up and running. And then I think I'd like to inform you about another venture around the Meerkat project, which is critically important. The Meerkat project, the ATN dish antenna framework, will consume considerable energy in terms of cooling the receivers and everything else that you need, the electronics that you need at the end of the day. And the Meerkat project is looking together with German co-investors, together with Eskom and other role players, to establish a concentrated solar power facility somewhere in the Northern Cape environment to feed the Meerkat from renewable energy. I think it's part of the strategic advantage we're trying to put on the table as far as our bid is concerned, to say that our instrument we fed off renewable energy resources. Exactly, that's precisely, that's where it comes from. And So the other first question about strategy determination, by and large, the strategies that we fund under that investment area that you see there are determined by all of the above and the people that you mentioned. It's industry investment, the government department investments. But at the end of the day, for us and what we measure ourselves against there is to say, how do these address the 12 strategic priorities of government? And do they cover that ground effectively in a way that we feel comfortable with? And if we don't and we do find holes, then we go look for partners to make those strategic investments in those areas that we think are really at short, are not being supported properly in that regard. So it really is a mix. I think in terms of the fundamental core science development, the strategic investments that are made there is a tripartite discussion between us as the NRF, the Department of Science and Technology. They say maybe we need more researchers in the field of education, for argument's sake, and we're underdeveloped in that area and we have to stimulate that. And then the academic community and say how can we stimulate research in the area of education research. We come up with a strategy and a plan and we fund it and make sure that we develop some core competencies in those particular areas. Chair, those are the questions. Thank you.
Even that needs also to be, because the Department of Energy, whilst it was still the Minerals and Energy, it established there is a bill, the Energy Bill, and under Energy Bill, that's where it establishes competencies in renewable energy, the SANERI Institute, the SANERI, you know, so it establishes all those things under that bill. And so, which means, therefore, that there will be a policy desk under those institutions, from which then the department, or the, in particular NRF in this case, can then zoom in and get, you know, to move with the whole energy, focus and planning, you know.
Chair, thank you. You reminded me now. The investment in the Center of Excellence are not just trade and industry, it's minerals and energy. So I've got the wrong department there. Sorry.
Another question?
Thank you, Chairperson. Quite a few questions here. I'll go through the presentation first. Just wanting to know the research chairs, the ones that were established for radio astronomy, the five at the end of last year, have they actually been appointed? Are there actually physical people in these chairs yet? And, then the $57.2 million extra money, and how does that link with your wish list of what you would like bursaries to be valued at? Does this go anywhere towards addressing your wish list here on whatever slide number this is? Okay, that's what I guess there. Then I was actually quite surprised to see how little you've allocated to Antarctic research, knowing that this is, you know, the Southern Ocean, it's all part of the Southern Ocean, and you're getting a new research vessel and all that sort of thing for Southern Ocean Research. And I think it's only 0.82%. Surely if we're wanting to be a sort of significant global player in that, we should be spending more on that. Then your government contract work for other government departments, is there any possibility that you will take on the Medical Research Council and the Agricultural Research Council? Because they need help, and you know, if you have this expertise and want to build it up and get more money from those departments, that might be a good way to go. Going back also to the Antarctic program, I understand there's a whole new strategy being developed around that, and you're taking over some contracts, international treaties from DTI, I think it is. Can you give us some insight into what's happening there? Yes, and the other things I wanted to go back to are sort of more historical. You know, last year the NRF came into a lot of flack with its its funding of research programs. And a lot of people that are involved in ongoing programs actually lost their funding. And I wanted to know what's happened to those people, if they've been brought back, if you've renewed or reviewed your research funding to sort of carry on with those programs. Also, your rating system. I think last year there was, 18 or 1900 practicing scientists that were rated by you. Is that improving at all? Are you reviewing that rating system as well? And if so, what is the progress there? As your recapitalization of the national facilities. Now, you've got to hear you say actual 37 million rand invested into infrastructure in 2 years. Is that in the past 2 years? So that's a historical thing. Okay, but 37 million in those 2 years. All right. So then you're looking for another 600 million on top of your recent stuff. Would that have refurbished by, assuming you get the money for the next 3 years, would that have then got all the facilities up to sort of par where you'd like them to be internationally competitive? And then your forced efficiency savings. I think it's a very ambitious program to try and save this amount of money over 3 years. How are you actually going to do this? What are you cutting out? That bothers me an awful lot, that there's a lot of money out of there. Okay, thank you, Jim.
Okay, let's allow him, because also there are many. Let's allow him after that you can then follow up. If there are a few, you can add on. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I think for me, for starters, is the strategic context, the last in page one, where you say contribute to the improvement of the quality of life of the people, of all the people of South Africa. I think that for me is profound, which brings me, because I didn't understand exactly what you were saying. My major concern and a focus in terms of doing my oversight is that majority of the people, communities in particular, are clueless about science and technology in the areas, in whether rural area, peri-urban, or even in the peri-urban areas. Now, how in doing the research, I don't know whether you were asking or you were saying about a dedicated person that is to focus into the community, the empowerment of the communities on issues and matters of science and technology. If you can clarify me on that, I'll be okay. The second one is, when you talk on student funding option, how definition of black, is it which I would have loved. Yes, I think that. Right now, this document has got no numbers. It also confused me. Some of the questions have been asked. There's a slide on divisional contributions, what focus. There are two pictures there. In the slide, and the other one fascinates me with young, yes, this young girls. Is it, how often do you visit schools of the, how often do you do, in your research, do you go out more often because I don't want to assume that it's only this, so that one will think that there is. But how often do you, and what is it that you're able to pick up from those? Because this picture gives me an impression that they're so excited, they're eager to know, they're eager to learn. Now, what is it what are the other things in doing the research that you have picked up from them? Is there some oral interaction with them, or is it only that they are looking into a computer and be fascinated like myself when I went to SKA last week? I think those are the two, because the other complicated one has then been asked, because I had some two questions that have been asked by Honorable Shin. There's another one that I wanted to ask about females. I will assume that you have got an effort, but is it a concerted effort to ensure that you produce female scientists right across, but more focusing on the African women? Thank you.
Just before you respond, please may you join me in welcoming the DG of Education has joined us. We have adopted a strategy these days that if we have matters that cut across committees, we do sensitize those committees or departments, you know, to be part of the joint sitting and observation. And I think along that line, that is why she is here with us. I'm sure most of us will know her, but she can introduce to us if at all other people don't know about her. Professor Metcalf.
Thank you, Chairperson. I did receive an invitation from yourself for the department to attend the next three meetings, and we indicated that we would come when we could. I've just completed a meeting with my own portfolio committee, so I've come really to listen. And I know that the acting DDG of Universities, Kriti Menon, will attend on the week of the 20th. And next week we have a portfolio committee workshop, so I'm not sure who will attend. But thank you for the invitation, because we think it's very important to work with this subcommittee as well as we're working with the department and the NRF. Thank you.
Yeah, because, I mean, NRF deals a lot with matters also of education, research, and so forth. So we thought it was useful that we must sensitize you on our interaction with them, because probably during the process of discussion, there may be matters that demand your knowledge to, you know, to clarify, and so it's better if we're together. Thank you very much for coming.
Chair, thank you very much, and thank you for the questions. Madam Shin, can I start at the top of your list and see if I can run through them? Thank you so much. First of all, the research chairs, the radio astronomy research chairs, there were five awarded to institutions, University of the Western Cape, WITS, UCT, Stellenbosch, and Rhodes. Two have been approved. In other words, this is where the institution has found a candidate and submitted a candidate to us in the department for vetting in terms of research chair quality. This is one of the things that we do generally as far as research chair is concerned. And so they will now be in the process of appointing them. The other three institutions are still looking for suitable candidates at the moment. So that's where we stand as far as that's concerned. The second question about the 52.7 and how that affects the ideal bursary values. On the right-hand side, you'll see ideal bursary values. For honors, it's 30,000 Rand. For masters, we estimate 70,000 Rand. Doctoral, 120. That will just give you a flavor of what we think is ideal. So, and what I'm going to do is just show you to the slide in terms of the adjustments we've made now. There we go. The honors are now up to 20,000. In other words, 10,000 short of the ideal. The master's is up to 40,000, which is 30,000 Rand short of the ideal. And the doctoral degree up to 60, which we think is about 50% of the ideal, if you really wanted to make it possible for somebody. The problem with this is this trade-off between do I go to the workplace or do I continue my postgraduate studies. And that's the long-term difficulties we have to deal with. So it's certainly a step in the right direction, but we're a long way from achieving our targets at the end of the day. That was in those reallocated values there. They've been worked in there already. Yes. Okay. All right. That's the next question is about Antarctic research. I think I can only agree that if we want to be a player in the Southern Oceans, we need to step up our investment there substantially. This is coming from a historic base. Remember, this is a program that's lay elsewhere. Originally, the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism funded the research, by and large, in this area, and they also provided the logistic support for the Antarctic Island initiatives with the old ships and so on. What's happened in the last few years is the Department of Science and Technology has taken over the funding of the research. So they've taken over the research bursary and or funding, and have increased it to the value of $14 million, I think is the number that I recall off the top of my head at the moment. I think the department is aware that we would like to try and increase that if we want to make impact. But the first requirement for us to step up our research in the Southern Oceans was for us to have a decent platform from which to do that research. And that's why the allocation of the money towards the new vessel over the next number of years that has to be built was the first priority. If we don't have a vessel that allows us to operate and do our research in the Southern Oceans effectively, then we can't justify the investment in human capital and other bits and pieces. But once the vessel is there, I think we can then step up our investment to try and tackle that and become more competitive in that area. The shift that you're indicating in terms of taking over programs, I suspect it may be the fact that the department is talking to the Department of Environment Affairs at the moment as to whether the DST should be fully responsible for the logistics as well as the science funding of this whole issue, or whether it should be split between the two departments. And I don't know what the outcome of that. Those are ongoing discussions as far as I understand. I don't think there's been clarity about that. But it really is to try and consolidate our research investment, and there's loose talk about a Polar Research Institute or something that we'd like to establish down the line. That's something in future music, I guess, in that regard. The contract work, MRC, ARC, a sensitive ground, and I'm not sure that I, as an NRF, would like to dive into this. There have been, when the NRF was formed, it was formed through an amalgamation of two components as far as grant making were concerned. It's the old FRD Foundation for Research Development, which had funded the natural sciences, and the CSD, which was associated with the HSRC, which funded the humanities and social sciences. And these two were grouped together 10 years ago now, 11 years ago now, into a single body called the National Research Foundation. At that stage, the MRC funding arm was invited to come on board. At that stage, that was the client. They make a small investment in terms of funding research as well. The ARC doesn't fund research in the same way. They don't have a grant-making mechanism, as far as I understand. They just do research. So the same way as the CSR or HSR actually do or perform research, they do that as well. We are in discussions with them to try and establish a sort of agricultural SRIP program or something to that effect, to try and help them to manage the investment. But again, it's a question of budget, and there's some sensitivities around that, because how much of their budget are they going to put out for competitive research, and how much are they retained to fund their own internal research? At the end of the day, they have to make a decision about that. So it's a little bit, I think that's something that's probably at the ministerial level can probably be discussed more effectively than from an agency perspective. Okay. The research programs, you asked about the people remember that I showed you, maybe I should just go back to that because I think it's quite an important question, if I can find the slide. The bottom line here, you'll see in this one, 79 million rand, is in an area that's called Focus Area Programs, that one there. And that is the programs that we're phasing out. The reason why we're phasing these out is essentially when they were established, when the NRF was formed, you know, the only strategic document that was available for the country at that stage was the RDP plan, essentially. And they were aligned with, are we delivering on the objectives of the country as far as the RDP plan is concerned? Since then, many strategy documents have emerged and have rolled out. And what we found ourselves was a funding framework that was speaking to a very old government strategy versus the need to fund existing priorities at the end of the day. So what we decided to do is to phase that. We didn't want to have two levels of strategy, you know, talking to each other. So we decided to phase these out. Yes, the academic community were not happy about that. But what we're doing is we're putting in place of those additional programs that we're funding. In other words, we've rolled out the Blue Sky Research Program. We've rolled out the competitive funding for unrated researchers. We this year rolled out the competitive funding for rated researchers. So what we're doing, and the incentive funding for rated researchers, those are the programs that we're funding. So by pulling back this money over a four-year period, we're reinvesting it in alternative programs. And I think the consequence of that shift in the funding landscape, first time in 12 years, created a lot of discomfort amongst the academic community, understandably so. And I think we tried our best to communicate that, but we certainly didn't get the message across as well as we ought to have. And I think it's my sense, looking back, we should have tried to do that a little bit better. But we were limited in the rate at which we could roll out the new programs by the rate at which we tried to claw the money back from the focus areas. We didn't want to cut people's funding off midstream and just launch a new program. So we're fading one out while we fade the other one in terms of investment. So that's what happened as far as that's concerned. But certainly that money is being reinvested in other programs that people can compete for. We're not taking that money away from people. The rating system, yes, the number of rated researchers have grown. We are just over 2,000 this year. So there's a steady growth happening there, which is encouraging. And it's also encouraging that much of that growth is happening in the social sciences and humanities, which has been a community that has been resistant to this process for some period, and with historical reasons, which is understandable, because they only came into the system much later than the natural scientists in that regard. We're doing many things to streamline that rating process, to make it more user-friendly, to try and reduce the social cost of the system in terms of the peer review requirements. And we've actually reorganized some of the rating categories a little bit. And all these responses were, and we've introduced the incentive funding scheme. In other words, so if you now become rated, there's an incentive for you to get a small amount of money per year to carry you through the bad patches as far as your funding is concerned. We want to encourage people to become rated because that means that they're nationally, internationally competitive. And that's what kind of career path we're trying to establish for people. So, yes, we're encouraged at the response we're receiving. Unfortunately, the reality is that 2,000 people, you know, we have lots of employed researchers in the system. This is about 11%, 11-12% maybe, of all employed researchers that are in the system. The majority of the people that belong to the rating system are people that publish internationally and have an international and national profile. And the reality is, unfortunately, in our science system, that of the 11 or 17,000 people that employ the scientists in the system, there are very few of them that actually produce international outputs of international quality. And I think last year, the statistic I shared with you in this regard is that of the 7,000 outputs in the international peer review literature that were produced last year, it was produced by about 3,000 authors in the country at the end of the day, which includes postgraduate students and postdocs and other people. So we have a science workforce. We have a science workforce that's not as internationally competitive as we'd like it to be, and we hope the rating system will push us in that direction. I think it's reflected in the PhD statistics you saw earlier as well. Those two speak to each other. When you have 31% of your academic workforce with PhDs, the number of people that are producing internationally competitive research is certainly going to be low in the system. So those are related in some sense. Recapitalization, the $37 million investment. Yes, we think, based on our work with the people at the national facilities, this is a bottom-up process that we followed, that kind of investment will really get us back on track. Back on par, I think, would be the term that I'd like to use. I wouldn't want to say that we'd be internationally competitive in every one of those arenas. But that would certainly clean up some of the backlog and make sure that we can move forward from then onwards in a sustainable manner to try and improve our competitiveness. Efficiency savings, the last question you asked. I tried to indicate there that, yes, it's difficult for us. We don't want to cut the grant budget because that, again, is going to impact on our research community, and that has long-term consequences, you know, for the system, which we feel uncomfortable with. We feel we're going to have to try and deal with it internally. That means not filling vacancies in the organization, cutting back significantly on our travel budgets, other bits and pieces where we feel we can get away with less visits to the institutions. You know, these are hard decisions that we have to make. There's no ways that we're going to achieve this holding back on some of the refurbishments and some of the buildings that we felt were required. And so these are tough business decisions that we're going to have to make to try and cut back that amount in the long run. We hope some of those cutbacks will be temporary and that the economy will turn and some relief can come in the future. But I think it would be poor planning for us to anticipate relief in that regard. So we're planning for the worst-case scenario, and then hopefully if relief should come, then that will be a wonderful bonus.
Okay.
And then the quality of life issue that you asked, ma'am, in terms of the public understanding of science. I think the point is that I try to make is that I think we need a driver to advance the notion of public understanding of science in the system. And I think SASTA as an organization is ideally positioned to fulfill that role. Traditionally, it hasn't been part of its mandate as it was envisaged. And I think this is a discussion one has to have. Is there room for broadening the mandate of that particular organization? And why that particular organization? I think that refers to your third question that you asked about the school visits and how frequently do we get out and talk to these kids and then interact with these kids. And SASTA has been a wonderful body to leverage the activities at the national facilities in a way that engages the community with science. If you look at the key performance indicators in the back of the book, you'll see last year SASTA made contact and had interactions with over 250,000 learners at a school level and over 4,000 educators and a large chunk of media people in that regard to try and promote the public understanding of science. So I think it's a body that has the potential to have a much larger impact if its strategic objective is slightly amended and maybe reassessed moving forward. But there are also many people that have these interactions at a provincial level, Cy Bono and other organizations that have similar kinds of impact. So I think there's an opportunity for us to streamline the effectiveness of that investment moving forward. The second question you asked about the student funding and breakdown, that is contained in the detailed projections and the key performance indicators. What we had here is just summary slides of the breakdown in terms of black, African, Indian, and colored participants in those targets. So please, that information is available in the key performance indicators. And if you'd like us to summarize those and send them through to you, we can certainly do that in some way that may be more digestible than this large table to try and deal with that.
Actually, I think, moreover, also between Africans and
South African Africans, yes. I think that's a critical distinction, and then we can certainly do that for you. Thank you. The fourth question you asked about female scientists, yes, it's a major driver for us. To be frank, we're having great difficulty in the total science system, and this is in higher education as well as the research environment, to retain talented black females in the system. There seems to be an extraordinary amount of pressure from industry and other partners to suck these people out of the research systems and other areas. There are not enough of them, and we have to keep working at it and increasing it. We have focused efforts to look at that. The Tatuka program does that. In other words, focuses on the establishment of female researchers in our system. But it also focuses on the establishment of female black researchers through the Rediba program, which focuses particularly on those individuals to say, how can we retain in the system and make sure that we grow their profiles? The successes are not remotely adequate. My own assessment. I think we need to step that up considerably. But it seems to me that the pipeline of black female researchers in the sciences is a very thin pipeline that we have to work with. And so we have to go all the way back to our undergraduate programs and see how we can restructure the access and increase the access at that level to try and get them to a postgraduate level where we think we... We have some wonderful role models, and remember we brought one of them along last year to share with you, Professor Tubela Nkong. I don't know if you remember, she made a presentation. Yeah, and she's a wonderful role model, and for those of you who don't know, she received the honorary doctorate from UNISA last night. And sorry that we couldn't be there, but we need more people like that, people that can fly the flag and convince young girls that science is a career opportunity and something that they should pursue.
Actually, just at that level, I was about to talk about that. You just stole my mouth. we once visited on our oversight role, Rhodes University. There is a very we were very impressed about the significant percentage of black researcher women there. And I think probably the committee, we will have to find a trip again and see how much progress they've made, because I think it was 2 or 3 years ago since we last went there. But actually, she was also leading a significant group of young women, Professor Mokokong, Professor Nyokong, there in her department of women researchers. So maybe
there's some areas where wonderful work is going on, and what particularly comes to mind is the Centers of Excellence. And in this regard, and I would suggest if you were going to look at a visit, series of visits, the Centers of Excellence would be something for the committee to consider and to see what's going on.
Can I interrupt? Chair, can I invite you, wearing my hat as the DVC for research at VITS, to visit the VITS Center of Excellence in Strong Materials? It is a marvelous center with dozens and dozens of students. Mm-hmm. Not as many women as we would like, but... because the area of physics is notoriously difficult to get women to take up. But I'd like to issue an invitation to you.
We'll chat it down.
As you were speaking, it just came into my mind. There are a number of certificate courses that are offered in different fields. And I am beginning to notice, taking one step back, there are not very few, if they are, of those courses on issues of science and technology. Even here in Parliament, if one wants to empower herself, she was just joking with me. She said, don't you want us to study science? On a serious note, I think that must be encouraged, maybe starting here in Parliament within the context of community empowerment, so that as people that are playing an oversight role, when we go out there, we really understand what is it when we are talking about science and technology. And it's quite, you said you can't develop or produce a PhD student above the age of 55. You can, okay. But more, that was only a lighter note. But I think maybe the Department of the Minister of Higher Education and Training, they will have to assist us on that. We will have to be a parliament that will have to take a first step, encourage members of parliament to be more, just the basics of science and technology.
Can I just come in on that? Actually, the WIP is new here, but we have a course here which we introduced. It's unfortunate that it has really not found fit yet. It was very, very attractive. We built it together with CSIR on innovation and technology management. It was starting from certificate to a degree to an honors, and actually it was cutting across even portfolio committees, because it was just looking at how technology can be utilized, and how can be managed to do innovative things. And it was offered by the University of Pretoria. I've got a certificate on that, which we were given here. And that course, we must talk about it, because Sister Njikelane was the one who was also spearheading that it should be there, but unfortunately, they wanted to promote the other causes, and they simply scaled it down until we had to give up, you know. But we did have a very, very advanced course. As a result of that course, we went as far as to introduce it at Moses Kotane Institute, because it was very powerful, and it did not need a person who is even full-time, because it was already structured and tailored for people doing other things and to interact with it. And it's a very important course.
Certainly wonderful idea, and I think let's follow up on the discussion, Chair, and if we can be assistance, and I'm sure that the Department of Higher Education and Training and other partners would help us to unlock some doors that maybe need a bit of a push in this regard, and I think it's something that we need to look at.
Something, yeah.
Chair and honourable members and guests here. First of all, Chair, my apologies for delay. First of all, to join you, Chair, to appreciate the presentation that has been presented by the NRF. I also notice here with appreciation, Chair, the reference to indigenous knowledge systems. and particularly its advantage in this field. But I would like to hear more if you can unpack what is your strategy in this field, because I know it is an area that has not received the attention I think it deserves. Perhaps for me, because I'm coming from a rural constituency, the ANC took me from OR Tambo. I'm the chief Nongonyana, by the way. so I'm passionate about this as a first thing. Second thing, and based on my rural background, I'm also biased in terms of rural. I've noticed the scholarships, the human development, and I think my colleagues did ask this question, but there's one thing that I would like, either now or later, because you refer to demographics, geographical spread, which is good, in other words, you're sensitive about these things. Question would be whether this is having an impact on rural constituencies in the country. Whether really children from rural that are more, of course, disadvantaged do access these benefits. Chair, these were the two things that I felt as much as raised.
Maybe I may then add my questions as probably the last lot for the day. You said something about the TRIP program had many concerns, especially from young innovators, in that they felt that once they came with ideas under this program, then those programs were taken away and then became university programs or somehow. I wonder if you can clarify that, because I remember the trade and industry saying that now they try to protect those people who come with innovative ideas, that their ideas are not swept away by companies or big establishments of research. And ever since, I've not had much of its success. Actually, a number of DTI programs of this nature have never really taken off like COLA and others. I wonder if you can give us some clarification if they are working now or not. The other one is, I forgot my specs. I can't see some of my things. The other one is about it's a very interesting the one that this the program, no, it's not this one, the one that you gave about the incentives that you had once imagined that they could attract students back into research, which I remember it was a project launched by NRF, the PhD project, and I said a lot about that when I gave an address at the Cape Peninsula Institute of Technology. And they have been very attracted, many students there, they've been very attracted to the point that even they were still demanding that they needed that paper, because it said so many things about that, because they said that is exactly the center of even the rector, they said that that's the center of problem in terms of research. So I was thinking that this is an initiative which the education, because fortunately they're here, which you must really seize it. Actually, they are saying that even here, because of that important component of my speech, they are going to even publish it in Parliament, in the Insertion Journal of Parliament, because they said it was a very important thing if the department has really come up with such an initiative, which means, therefore, that based on that, we can then market ourselves for further funding so that this initiative becomes a reality, because that's what they really liked at the University of Cape Peninsula. You know. So I thought that it was very important to come back to it, because it's very, very important. the other one, which also relates to it, in Sweden, they said that they no longer have students getting interested also in research, and in Japan, and in Taiwan. And as a result, they invited us. We once went there as a committee some 2-3 years ago, and they invited us that if we have students, especially in Sweden, who want to come and do research, that's what they are promoting. In Japan, they said they are promoting because of diversity on which innovation is based. And they said Japanese students don't want to go out of Japan. That's their problem. So there are no new ideas that are coming into Japan. So they are now inviting international students to come to Japan, and they are going to be looking after them financial-wise. And then they also in Sweden said the same thing, that as long as we are able to fund students for food, education from master's to PhD is free now in Sweden. So we can send as much students as we like if they want to do research. So I thought that this is also very important information for these people. And the same in Taiwan, they also said the same, because everywhere else in the world has a problem about research because of the financial strains that it puts on parents, on even the candidates themselves. So I think we have to find a way in tapering where the resources are, you know. We had even thought that in the Melsus Kotane Institute we would open up an office which will deal with the international a component of it, so that those students, firstly, who want to do skills profession could be able to be assisted through these kinds of efforts and so forth and so forth. Yes. So I thought that that is important. And the other problem which I have not heard you talking about, the University of Pretoria, Department of, I think, Veterinary Science, they said they have a serious problems about students taking this, and they associate this profession with farming and rural development, and which they feel that it's not part of them. And I remember that our deputy minister also did brief us about that during his time when he was a minister of agriculture, they really had problems about this. Actually, I think he said that in the University of Pretoria, they don't have more than 7 students doing this. Or maybe in PhD, maybe PhD, yeah. But it looked like, actually, myself, I was approached by the dean that there is a problem. Especially black students don't want to get into this. That's what the dean said. Said they don't want to get into veterinary and agriculture generally. They take it as a rural subject. So I think this is part of competency to deal with the situation. How far do you, if at all? I think I'll only at the last of the last three, SALT and SKA. You know, when we were given that lecture last week by that scientist, I can't remember the name, but it became clear that radio astronomy and therefore SKA is superior than SALT in terms of information that it brings about, because she showed us different, you remember, that this is what SALT would have given, this is what SKA would give. Now, my question is related to one of the questions that came from here. If SKA is superior than SALT, why did we not simply went into SKA? You see? Because it would have saved money. You know? Because SALT, oh, I don't know what it's called, is it NORT in North America? It's been there. They've always known, therefore, that SKA would be more probably superior than this one. And what is the story? What is the really logical argument? Why study this and end with that? You see? And then, well, I just wanted to, as a matter of information, that your National Zoological Gardens, are they part of where the authors host the birds zoo? There's a bird zoo that south of Pretoria, I think, around Sunnyside. Is that part of it? It's not part of it. That zoo is different from. Oh, okay. No, I just wanted to be sure. Finally, you said something about nuclear, also research development happening in the Itemba Labs. A very interesting one recently. In trying to solve the questions of nuclear waste management, is what they call accelerator-driven systems, which use accelerators to break these big actinide range isotopes, which are have long half-life. And are you also dealing with those parts here? Because I think that's one of the most important research these days. In accelerator in addressing nuclear waste management.
There's one more from EG Higher Education here.
Okay.
It was a question we actually asked earlier, but the status quo at the moment is that 31% of academics have PhDs. We all know we want to increase the figure dramatically. The question is, who does what and what is going to be done to achieve it? The NRF has a 5% will fund 5% of PhD graduates. So presumably, if you're going to increase the national target dramatically, it's going to come about either through NRF being funded a lot more or through another mechanism. The question is, what are the other mechanisms being considered? What are the targets? And what role will the NRF play in that? Would it be a shared responsibility, or would it be assumed with some other broader national plan? And then maybe, Chair, one last one then. Since I'm on
to how many last ones do we
have? If you look at our whole percentage of general expenditure on R&D, which is approaching 1% again, what percentage of that 1% is through the aegis of the NRF's activities, as opposed to, say, pure private sector or other SOE or whatever it is? Well, how much of that 1% is attributable to through your grant funding?
Is on. Can I start at the top of the list? Indigenous knowledge systems, sir. Just in terms of strategy, I think the department and us are the one that this program, when it was initially launched, didn't impact on the right community. It landed up becoming a biochemical program that was driven by drug discovery initiatives to start off with, and I think both us and the department felt truly uncomfortable about the way this was evolving. So at that stage, the program was terminated and pulled back. And we then put our thinking caps on and said, well, what are we really trying to achieve here in terms of indigenous acknowledgement strategy? And I think they've come up with a much better, much more balanced perspective that allows us to integrate the research community with the holders of indigenous knowledge in a much more systematic way. The investment level in this new program that's now been rolled out over the last 2 years or so, I think, if I remember correctly, is really trying to ensure that the beneficiation from any knowledge sharing in that regard goes down to the level of the community in as best possible manner. There is also a parallel program that's been launched by the department recently to look at community engagement research to be done by the rural-based universities around the country to ask them to get involved with their communities in terms of indigenous knowledge sharing and those kinds of systems. That's an additional injection of another 20 million rand that's going in on top of the current system. I don't think the research program is optimized. I think it requires some development and some rethinking and growth into the future to make the kind of impact, I think, so that you're asking of us in that regard. But at least I think in this stage the direction of the investment is more sound, and I think the direction of the investment will hopefully have long-lasting community impacts, the direction that it's going in at the moment. And that hopefully, the idea of rural impact, this is, first of all, I'm pretty much encouraged by the statistics I see at the NRF about the ability of students that come from rural backgrounds that really want to pursue a research career to do so. I mean, we have some wonderful examples of people that literally learnt mathematics under a tree as a school child and is now appointed as a professor, of mathematics at Wits, I think, is the one instance.
Vice-Chancellor,
yeah, to start off with. He's an even better example. But I think that they are wonderful examples of... Yes, Luiso, okay. And then there are a couple of other examples like that has really encouraged me, that I think we're starting to catch people and we're starting to make sure that we get people from all walks of life that can participate in this endeavor called research at the end of the day. I think that's really... there's so much untapped talent in the rural communities, I think, that we're not even getting to, and I think that's one of the major challenges that we have to try and deal with. So the issue of disadvantaged students has always been an issue, but I think for us key, and together with the Department of Higher Education and Training, is to say whatever we put in place as far as school systems, higher education systems are concerned, we need to make sure that we have a degree of student mobility that we put into the system. Because if people are born in a village in Limpopo and therefore they have to grow up in that village and their schooling is in that village and they never get the opportunity to go outside the context of that village, then I think our system will never be optimal. So a degree of mobility so people can go to secondary school, community colleges, higher tertiary education institutions in other parts of the country is critically important. And this is why these bursary values seem quite high, the ideal bursary values, but it must allow people to break out of their immediate environments and to participate in the broader activities of society in that regard. So that's one of the challenges I think we have to try and tackle. The rural impact, of course, also is one of the discussions, and I think maybe the DG of Higher Education Training is a better person to answer this than me, but I know there's some serious thought being given to the kinds of investments we should be making in R&D in the context of rural-based institutions. Do you want them to compete with WITS or UCT in terms of the kinds of expertise that they have, or should their expertise be more relevant and applicable in the context of where those particular institutions find themselves? You want them to be world-class at what they do, but it should be in the context of where they find themselves and the communities of where they are. So, but that's a discussion, I think, that the higher education training has sort of come out of the conference that we had a few weeks ago, that discussion needs to be taken forward. Chair, the SRIP program that you referred to, there was a large push from the Department of Trade and Industry to shift the criteria for applications in the SRIP program away from large industries towards investments by SMMEs. There was some resistance in the research community about that. They didn't feel comfortable with it. I think the thinking is that one also has to keep in mind who actually employs PhDs at the end of the day. Is it the SMMEs or is it the large industries? And so there was a bit of tension there in terms of the makeup of the program. I think the research community are now getting more used to the new criteria, which forces them to collaborate and draw in the SMMEs in terms of the collaborative research ventures. And I think it's happening more and more. So I'm quietly confident that that program is drifting in the right direction to make sure that the participation comes from many companies, small individual SMMEs and larger companies at the end of the day, and it's not just locked up into large industry, the way the original program was conceptualized. You mentioned the South African PhD project and the use of opportunities abroad to train our students. So we see that as a fundamental part of our strategy to push up our PhD productions fivefold, as we indicated to you last year. We don't have the supervisory capacity necessarily in our institutions at the moment to supervise all those students, and we are going to have to use spare capacity that exists abroad through our partners in that regard. The South African PhD project does precisely that. So what we're trying to do is to match up international funders with students that are looking at opportunities, together with potential sponsors from the private sector and the corporate sector, to support those students and then put them in a melting pot together with our local service providers, which are the local universities, to share all these opportunities that are available to students and they can actually participate. So part of what we're doing in the South African PhD project is to assimilate all those international opportunities that exist. They're available to students through a central portal that was launched last week when I ran away early to the PhD conference from your visit. And that people can access to say, what are the international science funding opportunities that exist for me as an individual that I can apply for to go to Sweden, to go to Japan, and all those information. So we're trying to make sure that the students have direct access to that information and that they don't depend on the supervisors or the university academics or heads of departments informing them about these opportunities at the end of the day. So we're trying to facilitate that from the NRF, because I do think we have to use those opportunities. Yes. We will lose some of those people, and they may stay in those countries for a while. But I always feel even if they come back 20 years later, they come back with a wealth of experience that they can add considerably to our economy. So sometimes one has to be bold to win in the long run. And then we see this as a 50-year strategy. This is not a 5-year strategy that's going to give us the kind of returns.
Actually, they say it's very important these days. What we used to call brain drain, it's no longer brain drain, it's brain gain, because they go somewhere to gain more brains and then come back, as long as they are going to come back.
And they come back. Yeah. We call it brain circulation, yeah. We want to come back and contribute. So I think, yes, absolutely. You then mentioned the idea of the veterinary scientists. We are concerned about that discipline. Remember, we have a program that's focused on disciplinary areas that we feel are underdeveloped. There's some intensive discussions going on through our Knowledge Field Development Directorate, the Faculty of Veterinary Science at the University of Pretoria, the National Zoological Garden, because they do similar kinds of work in the wildlife area in terms of wildlife diseases and also the captive breeding of endangered species, which is much to do in terms of reproductive technologies, which the veterinary people use. And there's a body called the Mammal Research Institute at the University of Pretoria. So collectively, these three bodies are putting their heads together to say, how can they grow? Because it is a fundamental concern for us that the research R&D capacity in the area of veterinary science has declined significantly over the last two decades in this country. And we actually, that's the only faculty, I think, on the continent that offers veterinary science. So this is of huge concern to us, and we have to put some special effort in there. But we're working together with the Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research at the University of Pretoria and the Dean of the Faculty of Science and the Dean of the Faculty of Veterinary Sciences to try and see what we can do collectively there. In that regard. And hopefully this is an opportunity for the National Zoological Gardens to interact with very active research groups to really up their game to the sort of levels we'd like to see as a national facility as well. The SALT SKA question you asked, the difficult one about the investment. My understanding is that for an optimal astronomy system to be in place, you would like to be able to observe the night skies using the full spectrum of electromagnetic radiation that's available to you. And that includes from the very short gamma rays to the intermediate optical rays and then the long wave radio. To get the best picture, you need to be able to have the full capacity. What we have at the moment, and this is one of the competitive advantages we have in our bid for the SKA, is precisely the fact that we have a very good optical capability at SALT. Because it gives you that particular perspective along those wavelengths. Added to that, now we have the long wave meerkat and radio astronomy capability. And added to that, we in Namibia have the HES capability, which can look at the very short radio wave lens, not radio lens, X-ray sort of spectrum. So collectively, these three instruments, MEERKAT, SALT, and HES, give us a huge strategic advantage over what's being offered in Australia, which is only going to be a radio astronomy facility. They have some optical instruments there, but they certainly don't have any HES or X-ray wavelength capabilities in Australia. So I think, Chair, the answer is that these things, I wouldn't say better. They give us different components of a picture, and collectively that picture will be better. I see them as complementary at the end of the day in putting a sound strategy to get together. NZG, we've answered that one, the question about the birds. Nuclear research development, waste treatment. I'm not aware, maybe Gacha, can you help me? Are you aware of any research on the treatment of dangerous waste products in as far as the accelerator based rice is concerned?
Chair, it was mentioned earlier in the presentation that each of these national facilities have flagship programs. The flagship program at Itemba is around the area of high energy nuclear physics, and more specifically the study of very rare nuclei of atoms that don't exist at the moment. The practical, envisaged practical solutions of discovering phenomena that exist in those sizes of nuclear is to map the behavior of very stable atoms all the way back to very fragile atoms, which would give you an insight into the kind of interventions one would want to do scientifically to break up atoms that are very, very stable. So in an indirect way, this basic research flagship program that Itemba Lab is supporting may give us some insights into how to intervene when radioactive nuclei are so long-lasting.
Now, you are right. I thought that you are doing it, but this is a new area of research which is happening in the field of reactor physics and nuclear engineering. I was simply appealing that probably our accelerators must start looking into that because it's a very, very important new field which is breaking up this actinide range of isotopes into stable atoms, and they call them accelerator-driven systems. Yes. And so I think we will probably want to upgrade our facilities to do some of those things because it's already... They call them transmutation reactions. So they are already dealing with them in the U.S. and in Japan. Okay, no, that's fine. Thank you very much for the information.
Thanks, Chair. And, Chair, there was just two more questions on my list here. The first was about the R&D expenditure, which is now creeping up to 1%, and what proportion of that flows through the NRF at the moment. I'm looking at the department here for guidance, but the figures I have at my disposal is essentially it's about 2.5 billion flowing through the NRF at the moment of the 16 billion or so, I think, total R&D investment. So what is that? 10%, something like that, in that regard. That's more or less the estimate. I'm getting 12, maybe a bit more than that, yeah. But so that's the figures that I have, but maybe the department, if they want to correct us, so please do so. And then there was a second question about the R&D, about the 31% targets and the strategies from the department. Maybe the DG is better positioned to answer that than I am. Please, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. As I understand it, the question is the relatively low proportion of PhDs amongst the teaching staff of universities and what we're going to do about it. Chairperson, as already indicated by my colleague, DDG Kobela, we find ourselves in a situation where we can set targets, and we would certainly like the targets to be higher. And between the targets and the institutions, the only mechanisms that we have are the steering mechanisms of policy. Now, when we look at the steering mechanism policy by which we can encourage universities to respond to the targets that we set ourselves and need their cooperation in fulfilling, I think the first steering mechanism is the emphasis that's placed in all of the funding on research. And there are several pieces of research recently, one of which was done by Chet, which looks at very close relationships between research output and PhD, people with PhDs in universities. And I think the point is very clear that you're not really going to be producing new knowledge if you haven't already got a PhD. It's unusual that somebody without a PhD is publishing, and certainly not an international fora. So the first incentive for universities, in order for them to fulfill the research targets that we've set, is for them to, within their own institutional mechanisms, prioritize staff acquiring PhDs, which means that universities have to be supportive in the way that they allocate resources so that they create opportunities for existing staff members to complete PhDs. Whatever incentive mechanisms that might exist within institutions that we can support, we will pursue. But in the end, I would say that as much as we can create incentives, as much as perhaps we can fund through the NRF targeted programs to accelerate people acquiring PhDs, the partnership between DST and NRF must result in supporting universities to take the steps that are necessary. I think that that needs to be linked to the point that was implied in one of the questions and taken forward by Professor Van Jaarsveld in terms of differentiation. I think that the point that was made is that universities may in fact have different profiles depending on their particular niche. And I like the spin that was put on it in terms of we expect excellence across all of our universities, but perhaps with slightly different missions. And the additional caveat that I would put is that even when a particular institution may not have as high a rate of PhD staff, we would expect all staff in universities to be scholars, even if they're not actively pursuing research. It's a question of a scholarly ethos in universities that would be non-negotiable for us. Thank you.
I think that's it from members now. I think everybody has exhausted all of the appeal. All that I can say now is to thank all of you for having come here, but I'm very glad that we have been able to share a lot of what is important in terms of developing our science systems, in particular the human capital in science and technology. This is very, very crucial, actually. Without this, there can be no movement in our economic growth. We can just dream about that it will move one day. And actually, under the course that we talked about, technology innovation management, they show that in the last 30 years, the world has moved from human and finance capital to technology parameter to determine the economic growth. So all countries that are rated as industrialized, they no longer look into the other two. They look into the technology parameter. So it's very important that we develop the human capital. It may not only be PhD project, because the DT of India, when he came here, Professor Mashalka, he gave a very good picture that we do not need only to develop the high sky research. We can actually, at the base of our communities, the biggest resource for innovation, because innovation can innovate in everything, even in the door, and make better life and get wealth. So I think therefore NRF is better put in the science system to give us this goal. And without that, what you showed, because of the bulk of majority of people who are potential researchers, they rely on that base, and they need that type of support incentives in order for them to move out above the ground and participate in the economy. So I think with that, thank you very much for having come and shared with us. The only problem that our community, from my experience, has is that we discuss threat plans like this, and it becomes the end. We will only see you when you come for annual reports. And this interaction of really monitoring, you know, and interacting, then it becomes, and it's not by anybody's fault. It's because also parliamentary programs are very hectic by themselves. We can't even finish our own work sometimes, yeah. But also ourselves, you see. But with the system being wider as it is, we could be able to tap from one time to another if we had enough time in Parliament. But that is why, again, because when we come to Parliament, that's when we must have ideas and build one another in order for the system to develop quicker. And without that, there is no way, because we are public representatives. We hear from constituencies what are the concerns. And that's why I say public representatives have got to be a diversity of everything, so that if they sit with you who are tasked with special duties, you are able to tap into all diversity of what is there out in the public. And so that is why it is very important to keep on constantly interacting. And I think with that, I thank you very much for having been with us today. We will try and see, especially facilities like they've been recommended to vets and others. We'll have to discuss with the department to help us with a lot more of such facilities that need to be visited. There is one that was always in the offing, which was, they say, a technology, a very high technology launch for where they once wanted to launch some satellites from here, from South Africa or something like that. We need to also see some of those facilities. Yes.
OTEC, I think, is
No, thank you very much, honorable members and everybody else. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair, and honorable members. Thank you very much.
Announcements, which I thought, where did I put this clip? Okay, can you just, because I may not see very well. My secretary is going to make some of these announcements because I can't see very well.
Okay, Chair, it's noted there that the visit that we were supposed to have on Friday can no longer take place due to the management not being available on the date. They want us to look at another date, which we will do. Then there's a biotechnology association, a group of Polish students who wanted to see the committee tomorrow at 1 o'clock. We proposed, but now they're not available at 1 o'clock. They're requesting that we actually go there to the Grand Western at about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so we need to make a decision around that. And then the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry invitation, they're having their brief on the Intellectual Property Rights Amendment Bill, which is very crucial for our committee. So, and that is on Tuesday after the sitting of the House. It's tentatively put at 15:30, it might be, but depending on how the proceedings in the House go, but it's going to happen in the afternoon. Then there's the ICT Africa 2010 in Durban. The committee received the invitation because DST is hosting it. So we need to decide, and people need to confirm if they're attending that so that we can do the application to Parliament. Then there's an invitation to the African Indigenous Knowledge Systems Conference 2-3 June, which also the committee received the invitation, so we must decide if we're going to send a delegation or the whole committee is going. So those are the 5 points.
There's another one. Sorry, I forgot. There's another one. Also, where the committee has got to send at least 3 delegates, probably, as per our formula, 2 from ANC, 1 from the opposition party. It's hosted by the Japanese in Zambia. they call it the Japan Africa e-learning forum. They are introducing a new e-technology in distance learning. So probably we thought that we must work on that and see. It's on the 25th of May, so it's very nearby. It's hosted by actually the ambassador of Japan to of Japan to the United Nations. He will be leading the delegation from Japan. So I would therefore ask members to start thinking about delegates that they can send, and they must submit the names to Shanaz once we have decided. Okay, thank you very much. Otherwise, those are the few announcements that we have.